Thank you, Padmadaka. Brothers in the Dharma. So we're looking at these four acceptance verses this weekend, which go, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. And as Padmadaka has already said, we looked at the first two of those verses, the first two verses, yesterday. Tonight we come to the third and fourth of the verses of acceptance. I did say that I might go on tomorrow morning if this talk was going on too long, but I've just decided to go for it. So, you know, I don't mind if it's going on too long if you want to lie down and have a snooze, but I really won't mind. But I do want to kind of get through it tonight. I think if I broke it up, it would be a bit weird. So we're just going to have to go for it. I don't know how long it'll be, but let's just see what happens. We accept ordination for the attainment of enlightenment. Ordination into the Western Buddhist order, the Trilokya Bauddha Mahasangha, is taken in order to attain enlightenment. It is longing for enlightenment that fuels our going for refuge to the three jewels, that fuels our spiritual endeavour. And it's certainly why I became a Buddhist. Not that I knew when I first came along to Buddhism what enlightenment was, of course not. My response was intuitive, faith-based. I'd had a sense of something when I read Buddhist texts, when I was around Buddhists. There was a scent, a perfume, that seemed to come from somewhere else. It's hard to really put this into words, but when I look back at my early spiritual yearnings and early involvement in the Dharma, in the movement, my early meetings with Bhante, with order members, there was something different, something special, magical, that seemed to inform things. Yes, the ideas held together as well. The more I read, the clearer things became. But it was what you couldn't put into words that drew me on, and it still does. The kind of thing I'm getting at is what happened, you know, the first time I went along to FWBO activities when Buddhadasa was doing classes in a private house in Brighton. And the first class I went to was a 50-minute metta bhavana and a sevenfold puja with mantras. And when I recited the puja, I just had this intuitive sense, this very strong intuitive sense, that this was going to be my life. I was going to devote my life to this. And it wasn't just what was in the words of the puja. It's what they were evoking, what they were pointing to, I suppose. Listening to some of Bhante's lectures, particularly I remember on listening to him on tape, his lectures on the Bodhisattva ideal, especially when he spoke about the bodhicitta. There's a kind of thrill that ran through me, and it was more than the words. It wasn't about definitions. It was what was being evoked. And again, particularly I think of meetings with Bhante, and particularly my ordination, particularly my private ordination. So I was introduced to something, well, not of this world, and yet mediated by the world. Interestingly enough, Padmapani this afternoon gave me this photograph, which was taken just before my private ordination. It was absolutely thrilling to see it, of this 19-year-old with, you know, long hair, looking down and looking rather worried, in a Tibetan shirt and big beads, and Bhante with long hair and really sort of beautiful robes. But it all sort of brought it back to me, seeing that photograph. And I remember on that ordination retreat, Bhante did a seminar on Milarepa's Shepherd's Search for Mind, and he started to talk about mind, the true nature of mind. And, well, unbelievably as it may seem, as he spoke, I think more than just me, I think a number of us, you sort of knew what he was talking about. So it's that kind of thing that motivated me and still does, something pure, magical, strange, something locutra, beyond the worldly, transcendent, but manifesting through the words, through the rituals, through the people. And even though in my time in the order I've been through some dark and difficult times, I think I can say that it's always been that has kept me practicing, that it's been that's kept me at it, that dimension, that scent, that flavour, that spirit is to me the most important thing of all. Without it, everything is meaningless for me. I might do good deeds, I might be friendly to a lot of people, and so on and so forth. But without meaning and value, but they're without meaning and value, unless there's that scent, that flavour. Enlightenment is the essence of Buddhism, the heart of Buddhism. So if we're not relating to enlightenment, if we're not orientating ourselves towards enlightenment, then what are we doing? What is the meaning of our lives? What is the meaning of ordination? But the question is, how do we relate to enlightenment? How do we approach it? Some people might even think that we shouldn't even look at this question. To even have a talk on this subject is sort of dangerous. Enlightenment's too vast. It's altogether overwhelming. And in any case, surely, trying to sort of speak about the unspeakable, you'll only end up sounding glib and all the rest of it. Isn't it preposterous to kind of go into it? Maybe we should forget about it and just concentrate on the next thing to be done. I think there's some wisdom in that. I've seen people over the years get very cranked up about gaining enlightenment. I've got very cranked up about gaining enlightenment and gaining insight. And I've seen people really push and push and push. I've seen myself push and push up, push, give up this, give up that, do loads and loads of sitting in meditation. You know, really sort of give oneself wholeheartedly to things. But then, ping, crash, it all unravels. How many times does one see people, you know, make announcements about how they're going for insight and then they stop meditating and stop being celibate and all the rest of it? Probably we've all done this in one way or another. And in this talk, I'm certainly not trying to work us all up into a kind of fever pitch about going for it. I couldn't do that because you're a far too intelligent and hard-headed audience. So there's no way that I'm going to attempt to kind of work you all up into a kind of fever pitch about gaining enlightenment. You'll see through that. I hope I don't do that anyway. But nonetheless, we've gone for refuge in order to attain enlightenment. It's an essential part of the meaning of ordination. So presumably, we have some response to enlightenment and insight, which is, after all, the first dawning of enlightenment. And I mention insight because it's a kind of related theme, I think. Because it becomes up regularly. I get so many questions, usually on going for refuge retreats. And, you know, is there anybody in the movement, in the order, who has insight? Where are the stream entrants in the order? I mean, you get questions like this. And are there conditions conducive for the attainment of stream entry and attaining insight? And I must admit, I'm always left with the question, well, what do you mean? What do you mean by insight? You know, we can say insight, we can say enlightenment, but what do you actually mean by it? It's incredible. People ask these questions and you ask, well, what do you mean? And sometimes they scratch their head. You know, they've heard it's a good and important thing, but actually they're a bit vague about what it means. Also, it's quite a good question to ask, well, what for? Why? Why do you want insight? It's kind of interesting when sometimes it almost seems to me that these discussions about insight, it's almost like the equivalent of being saved. You know, who's saved in the order? How can we be saved? Will we be saved? You know. And I think it's quite good to maybe examine our motives and assumptions and all the rest of it. But often the discussion, I think, bases itself on a particular premise when there's discussion of insight and enlightenment. I feel But very often it's mainly thought of in cognitive terms, in terms of what you know, that you know directly, say, the truths of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and insubstantiality. You have clear, penetrating insight into those truths. And of course, that's of very great importance, that way of talking about it. But enlightenment is spoken of in ways other than in terms of knowledge, other than the kind of metaphor of knowledge. That is only one way in which the Buddha spoke of it, even though in the Pali text it's probably the predominant mode. Enlightenment is spoken of in many ways in Buddhist tradition. Its presentation in Buddhist literature is broad and rich and varied. And this is explored brilliantly, in my view, in chapter 14 of the Three Jewels, in the Dharma section of the Three Jewels, entitled The Goal. The goal is, of course, atakavacharo, beyond thought, beyond the reach of reasoning. It cannot be put into words. Words, concepts, cannot get at it. Even as Bhante points out in that very underrated but brilliant lecture, Enlightenment as Experience and as Non-Experience, to describe enlightenment as an experience is saying too much. How can it be an experience? Because enlightenment transcends self and other. So how can it be an experience if there's nobody to experience it and nothing to be experienced? Anyway, having said all that, the Buddha and the great teachers down the ages did try to put enlightenment into words, did try to voice the voiceless in so many different ways. What I want to do in this talk is look at some of the ways in which enlightenment is spoken about. I want to do more than just describe talk about these different descriptions. I want to see what the implications the different descriptions have for our own lives, here and now. Knowing, even in theory, more about the goal of our lives or the principle which informs our lives will affect the way we live our lives, surely. Now, in that section on the goal, Bhante tells us that descriptions of enlightenment can be classified in four ways: negatively, positively, paradoxically, and symbolically. I'm going to go through these. Some I'm going to treat in greater detail than others, and I'm not going to go through it in the same order that he gives it in the book. So first of all, negative descriptions. These descriptions tell us that enlightenment is the complete and permanent eradication of all unskillful mental attitudes. So enlightenment is described as the destruction of the ashravas, the poisonous fluxes, the destruction of the kleshas, or the extinction, the complete extinction of craving, aversion, and ignorance. Because all such states have been eradicated, it is also described as the cessation of dukkha, the cessation of suffering, dukkha nirodha. Descriptions of enlightenment in terms of cessation, negative descriptions, are, I would imagine, not that popular. We prefer, I think, the positive descriptions. I know I do. They give us, after all, something to work towards, something that draws us on. But descriptions of enlightenment in terms of what it isn't are important. If we don't refer to them, our perspective on the Dharma is skewed. And there's a danger that our practice will just support a rather worldly life. Our Buddhism will be worldly life with knobs on. Enlightenment, as it were, contradicts us. It provides a critique of us and how we are living. It's almost as if the Buddha, as the embodiment of enlightenment, one aspect of that is that there's a constant critique of our lives. I think there of the wrathful aspect of Padmasambhava's wrathful smile. This critique should not provoke feelings of guilt or unworthiness, but rather a clearer sense of where we stand and of how things are. Let's look at one of the most basic things that is eradicated in enlightenment: craving, trishna. In enlightenment, there is no craving at all. It's the complete cessation of craving. You can't get around that. No school, as far as I know, has denied that, not even the tantric schools have denied, that enlightenment is the cessation of craving. But what are we to do in relation to that? You know, is it that immediately we just got to cut out any craving at all and feel bad when we eat a cream cake or have a second helping or make love or whatever? Or go to the other extreme and, because we don't want to feel bad, come up with some fancy rationalisation for our cravings? You know, we're exploring the depths. Or just pretend that, just ignore the unpalatable truth that enlightenment is the cessation of craving. Just pretend that that aspect of things isn't there. You know, just not bother with that. Just ignore it. I don't really think that any of those alternatives do much good. I think perhaps it's more a case of getting into view what the Buddha had to say about craving. He didn't say, as far as I know, that craving was bad or evil. I've never come across that. Certainly not in the way we might have heard it in other religions. He just said that it was the cause of pain. And when he talked about craving, he didn't just talk about craving for sense experience, karma trishna. He talked about craving for being, or craving for existence, bhava trishna, and craving for non-being, or not being, or non-existence, vibhava trishna. Craving for sense and these aren't really separate cravings. It's as if our craving for sense experience is just the hook for deeper, more existential desire. We want to be, we want to live forever, in some sort of way. We want to be the same all the time, forever. We crave that permanent being. And our various sense desires are an attempt to kind of shore up some sort of sense of permanent existence. I remember noticing this at Guhyaloka when you get into the silence there, when you're doing a lot of six element practice and meditation, noticing how much I was kind of looking forward to the end and thinking about going home and how wonderful it would be, you know, and I'm going to read the paper and there'll be the World Cup results and, you know, there's the cricket on and, you know, and then you get home and there's a nice cup of tea and, you know, you're going to watch the telly when you go and see your mum and dad and all the rest of it. And I'd catch myself and think, well, hang on a minute, hold it. You know, you're setting up this nice vision, but you're assuming that it's going to be there, that you're going to be there. That's quite an assumption. You don't actually know what's going to happen next. It's a kind of craving for being. Would I be alive? Would I be the same? Would it be the same? But there's not just craving for existence. There's also craving for non-existence. This one's strange in a way. A kind of desire for nothingness. We can see it as a desire to just close everything down. You know, just desiring sleep, narcosis. Wanting to just dull and numb everything. Just blot everything out. How much of our craving is an attempt to blot everything out because life is too painful or just too confusing? It's interesting to consider, I think, craving in these terms. They're based upon, this craving, therefore, is based upon, bound up with not seeing the way things are. The change, the flux, the becoming. So we want to fix things or shut out and avoid. This is why craving is so problematic. Why it's a sort of source of pain. Because we're out of touch with what's happening. Or rather, we're taking hold of only one aspect of life. If we look at the teaching of Pratitya Samutpada, we notice that it's presented in two different ways. It's presented on the one hand in terms of arising, this being, that becomes, and so on. On the other hand, it's presented in the same formula in terms of ceasing or passing away, this not being, that does not become. These two processes are actually happening all the time. At the same time, in every moment, there's an arising and a ceasing. There's continuous arising and ceasing. Right now, there's arising and ceasing. every breath, every inhalation and exhalation is an arising and ceasing. In every moment there's an arising of thoughts and feelings and a ceasing of thoughts and feelings. Heraclitus says, to be is to not be, and not to be is to be. Heidegger, I believe, says somewhere, being never fully flowers. The trouble is, we usually take hold of one side of the process. We take hold of the arising. So we crave, grasp, cling to people, experience, things, ideas, institutions, position, whatever, ourselves, as if they will always be there, as if they'll be always arising. We don't pay attention to the other side, the ceasing, the passing on. And we take hold of the ceasing too, as if that was the only truth, that all just goes, that there's just going to be loss and depression, and there's a desire to not be, to make it all go away, to make it be nothing, numbing ourselves. So this is Bhava Trishna and Vibhava Trishna. Neither work, because they're not seeing what is really happening, the continuous arising and ceasing. When you contemplate arising and ceasing, it gets very interesting because you start to just glimpse that how mysterious life actually is, how rich and wonderful. You start, well, even the description in terms of arising and ceasing sort of breaks down. And craving, using the senses to try and get some kind of permanent sense of being or to make it all go away, seems such a simplistic, crude response to the richness of what's happening. A Buddha, it seems, is happy, blissful, at the continuous arising and ceasing. As Milarepa sings, oh, happy are the myriad manifestations. The more ups and downs, the more joy I feel. It's strange how looking at enlightenment as the destruction of craving, we arrive at happiness. Might seem strange, at a positive description. I want to look at happiness and bliss a bit later, but let's not go there too soon. Let's stay with what enlightenment isn't. It's not only that in enlightenment there is no craving and so on. There is no you or me at all. Banti in that lecture, Enlightenment is Experience and is Non-Experience, says, enlightenment is the experience to end all experiences. The whole structure of consciousness is taken apart. Grasper and grasped, self and other. In that sense, enlightenment can be described as death. I believe in the Zen tradition, enlightenment is described as the great death. And in our own tradition, Banti in his system of meditation has given us the stage of spiritual death. This is represented particularly by contemplation of the six elements, but by any of the Vipassana practices. He's also, in another place, I believe, spoken of this stage of spiritual death as a basic principle of the path. Spiritual death, in a way, should be going on all the time. All the time, certain things need to be dropping away, dying away. Or you see what needs to drop away. I think experiences like shame, remorse, humiliation, and so on are precursors of the great death. I was asked recently if I'd had any experiences which I would describe as insight. And I had to think about it, and I said, well, I'm not sure about that, but I think the nearest I've come to it is in experiences of shame and humiliation. I think that's where I've experienced it most, where I've come to the end, if you like, of myself. Sometimes, of course, these experiences can be very intense. We can have a sort of identity crisis. We don't know who we are. All the familiar landmarks that we've used, even Buddhist landmarks, have been taken away. There's a verse in the great Chan classic, the Blue Cliff Record. It's one of my favourite verses, and it's by Chao Chu, and he describes a great awakening. So you must imagine somebody who's been sitting for many years, very intent on their practice. And this is what he says. This is regarded as a great awakening verse. The cock crows in the early morning. Sadly I see as I rise how worn out I am. I haven't a gown or a shirt, just the semblance of a robe. My loincloth has no seat, my pants no opening. On my head are 3 or 5 pecks of grey ashes. Originally, I intended to practice to help save others. Who would have suspected that instead I would have become a complete idiot? And there's a commentary on this verse. If one can truly reach this realm, whose eyes would not open? Though you go through upsets and spills, all places are this realm, all places are this time and season. The 10 directions are without walls, and the 4 quarters are without gates. Mention of a Chan text is a good cue, I think, for the paradoxical descriptions of enlightenment. In The Three Jewels, Bante tells us that the paradox is a figure of speech widely current in mystical literature. In this context, it may be defined as the attempt to describe an ineffable state or experience by the forcible juxtaposition of contradictory attributes. Dionysius speaks of the deity as a deep but dazzling darkness. We're probably most familiar with the paradox in the form of the Zen koan. But Bhante sees the Prajnaparamita literature as the spearhead of the paradox in Buddhist literature. For example, in reality, there are no sentient beings to deliver. Therefore, the bodhisattva should vow to deliver them. One should abide in a state of non-abiding. Nirvana should be attained by means of non-attainment. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness no other than form. For some people, hearing or reading this material was what inspired them to practice the Dharma in the first place, as if they were given a glimpse of the ineffable, but that this juxtaposition of contradictories pointed to. We mustn't forget, of course, Bhante's initial awakening to the Dharma through reading the Diamond Sutra. Meditation, we can meditate on these paradoxes. I know of one order member whose main practice is contemplation of the paradoxes in the Heart Sutra. One of the purposes of paradoxical literature is to attack literalism. The Prajnaparamita literature attacks the categories of Buddhist thought that have become fixed and rigid, attacks the tendency to literal-mindedness. This is not just an interesting episode in the history of Buddhist thought. It's a human tendency. We have a tendency to make Buddhist teachings fixed and rigid. When we make contact with the Dharma, sure, we respond with faith. We have that intuitive sense of enlightenment. But we also conceive of the Dharma in a particular and limited way. We have an idea about it. It's like this, and spiritual life is like this. And that's a necessary start. But if we do really practice, and we practice within the context of a spiritual community and with a spiritual teacher, eventually that view will be overturned. There'll be a broadening, an expansion. New experience will enter in, new information. I can't think of a better word. New information, new truths will enter in, and it can be very puzzling. We start to live in a paradox. I recently have been having a series of letters from a young order member, somebody I've ordained, been ordained for a few years now. And it's quite clear that this is the territory that he's in. Let me read you from one of his letters. I asked him if I could, and he said I could. I want 2 seemingly opposed things, and yet both are necessary. I want to be a monk. I want to be a lover. I want to be distant from the world. I want to be sensually involved in the world. I want to be solitary, and I want to be in relation to others. I want clarity, and I want the magic of ambiguity, hiddenness. So I've had many letters like this, and all sorts of moods and feelings, and a kind of explosion of images within his consciousness. It's clear he's having a blissful, but tense and confused and weird and creative time. And I was so pleased. I rejoiced. Of course, some people might counsel, faced with those dichotomies, that he should go to one side of the equation. Become a monk. You know, forget all that lover stuff. Or some people might say, no, become a lover. Forget all that stuff about clarity, being a monk. You know, get into your depths. Of course, it's not about either. You have to live with the paradox. Don't close prematurely. You have to live in the paradox. You go for refuge in the paradox. You go for refuge in the contradictories. The kind of contradictories thrown up for that order member, I think, are a sign of progress. And maybe you could say, if we're not coming up against such contradictories, is our practice alive enough? Are we actually shaking up our literal mindedness? Do you know, I think the order itself is a kind of living paradox. There are so many contradictories, so many contraries within the order. I won't, you know, go into them. And of course, the fact that the order is evolving and changing and expanding just feeds the contraries, the dichotomies that it encompasses. And it's very tempting to say, oh, the order is this or the order is that. And very often, they're one side of the equation. And we have to learn to live with the ever-changing contraries and intuit the higher spiritual principle that actually resolve them all. It's not surprising our order is like this because Bhante's like this. Bhante's, I think, a very paradoxical figure. There's a painting in our community lounge, which I love, painted by Arloka, a big painting. And it's a painting of Bhante as he looked around the time of, you know, the 70s, around the time that some of us, around the time I was ordained. And he's wearing his monk's robes, and yet he's got long hair and beads, and he's smiling, he's got this grin on his face, and he's seated in meditation. And it's a really fascinating image. I mean, I love it partly because of its associations, you know, with the time that I first made contact with him. But there's something else about it, why I think it's an important image. Because, you know, you've got the monk's robes, you've kind of got the Buddhist past. And you've got the long hair, you've got the actual present. You've got the kind of past, Buddhist history, Buddhist tradition, meeting in a kind of a contemporary situation. And of course, at that time, it was very much the early days of the creation of the order. So it's, I think, a wonderful picture in terms of seeing the paradoxes of Urgyen Sangharakshita. When he was here the other day, I said, oh, look, this is you, Bhante. And he had a good look and he said, oh, I don't like that image of me. I said, I suppose I looked like that in those days. There was no suppose about it. You did, you know. Okay, so let's move on. Anyway, I think you got the point about paradox. Okay, so let's move on to the positive descriptions of the goal. In The Three Jewels, Bhante approaches this, I think, in a very interesting way. He says that descriptions of enlightenment, of necessity, have to derive from the conditioned. And he has to use the categories of the conditioned. So he looks at the positive descriptions using the categories of the five skandhas. So you can consider enlightenment in terms of form, in terms of rupa. This, he says, is the same as the symbolic descriptions. He also calls it the poetic. Such descriptions range from similes and metaphors, such as the farther shore or the magic city, right through to the rich, glowing and luminous visions of the Pure Lands, and the descriptions that you find in sutras like the Avatamsaka Sutra, descriptions of reality as intersecting beams of different coloured lights, or in the Tantra of reality being a mandala palace filled with Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, gods and goddesses. Then there's feeling. You can look at enlightenment in terms of feeling and emotion. I want to look at this in a bit more detail later on, so I'll leave that for a minute. And then you can look at it in terms of perception, or the Sangnya Skanda, which he says is looking at enlightenment in terms of knowledge. And of course, this is the predominant mode in Buddhist tradition. Enlightenment is spoken of as vidya, prajna, jnana, bodhi, describing a direct intuitive insight into the true nature of things. And this arises from the contemplation of basic Buddhist teachings. Then you can look at enlightenment in terms of the sanskara skanda. You can look at it in terms of will, in terms of volition. And here he says, in particular, enlightenment is described as freedom, liberation, emancipation, vimukti, vimoksha, absolute liberation from all restrictions. And a lovely little comment from Bhante about freedom, the meaning of freedom in Buddhism. In a spiritual sense, bondage is subjection to oneself. True freedom is freedom from oneself. And then fifthly, you can look at enlightenment in terms of consciousness. Enlightenment is described as a state of absolutely pure, blissful, and radiant consciousness. Obviously, much more could be said about all of these descriptions, and some of them are probably a particular favourite of each of us. But I want to move on to two more descriptions. I want to go into them in more detail. I want to look at them in terms of feeling and emotion. I'll deal with that last. But before that, I want to consider enlightenment as a person, what Bhante calls an absolute person. So enlightenment as a person. In the Three Jewels, Bhante points out that descriptions of the goal in terms of knowledge, will, and so on are somehow inadequate. They are abstract, and for that reason they don't always carry conviction. And this is where enlightenment as a person comes in. This is where the Buddha comes in. The Buddha is the living embodiment of all the qualities of enlightenment. They are all there embodied, and so they speak to us more powerfully, more directly, more vividly. After all, personality is really our highest category. Forget the doctrine of not self and all that. In ordinary human terms, our personhood is extremely important to us. We are a living, breathing, aware person. We cherish our personhood. We cherish the personhood in others. That's the basis of metta, cherishing our own personhood and identifying the personhood of another. So it's perfectly natural to see, to want to see, enlightenment as a person, as the highest person, the perfect person. And in the Three Jewels, Bhante points out that if you prematurely conceive of enlightenment as transpersonal, there's a great danger of seeing it as infrapersonal. By that I take it to mean subpersonal. In other words, it becomes empty and devoid of any kind of life and vibrancy. In early Buddhism, of course, it was even more natural for people, for disciples of the Buddha, to see enlightenment as a person because of the overwhelming presence of the Buddha. Some texts even show people practicing recollection of the Buddha when he wasn't present as a means to enlightenment. There's the wonderful Pingya Sutta, which is a great favourite, I think, in the FWBO, where old Pingya constantly recollects the Buddha. The Buddha is with him night and day. There's a very, very beautiful story about Ananda in the commentary to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which tells how Ananda left Kushinagar and went to Shravasti, went to the Jeta Grove, and he went into the Gandakuti, the perfumed chamber, the hut where the Buddha stayed, the cottage where the Buddha stayed. And he swept the floor, laid out a seat, brought water, and he sat as if the Buddha was actually present. Buddha Ghosha sort of dismisses this as Ananda's excessive attachment to the Buddha. I disagree. I take it to mean that this is Ananda's practice of Buddhanusmriti, recollection of the Buddha, recollection, therefore, of enlightenment. It's one of the origins, I think, of puja and visualization, Ananda's behavior at the Jetta Grove after the Buddha's parinibbana. Of course, in Buddhist history, there are many developments which really take sort of meditating on the Buddha as a person. It's taken much further. There's the eternal Buddha of the White Lotus Sutra, continuously teaching the White Lotus Sutra on the vulture's beak. There's the various Pure Lands, Akshobhya's Pure Land Abhirati, and of course, more famously, Amitabha in Sukhavati. There's the Trikaya doctrine. There's Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, cults of different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And then, of course, there's the great plethora of deities of the Vajrayana. There's faith, devotion, puja, worship. And of course, these practices continue in our own order with puja, and especially with our sadhanas, with our individual visualization practices. Our sadhanas represent our meditation upon our particular transcendental person, or rather the form in which the absolute person manifests to us personally. Our own particular vision, if you like, of enlightenment. I remember at my private ordination, Bhante said to me, "Okay, now it's time for you to take visualization practice." And he said, "This is you at the end of the path. You're contemplating yourself at the end of the path. You're contemplating yourself after you've spiritually died." Interestingly enough, he also said, "This is what you really are, but you haven't realized it." This is if he gave me both the transcendent and the immanent approaches to enlightenment. Both have their own value. Both are important. But our sadhana represents our meditation on an image of a person, a transcendental person, that reflects our most profound spiritual aspirations and longings. We contemplate such a form in order to keep alive and develop our sense of enlightenment. So this is the principle of sadhana. I'm trying to avoid the expression visualization practice. It's the principle of being introduced to the enlightened person. It's not primarily a meditation technique or even a meditation practice, although there are recommended ways to meditate on these forms. But the method of practice is secondary. What is primary is the image of the person and our aspiration towards it. And the way you do that in meditation needs to derive from that, needs to derive from the aspiration. This is something that we're getting clearer on these days, and it's something that private preceptors are trying to learn more how to do, how to introduce people, how to help people discover their transcendental person. I'm using that word, it might not be the best expression, but never mind. And the best way, the most effective way for them to meditate upon it. Sadhana, after all, means an effective ritual, an effective method of spiritual practice. So you might have your sheet of paper with it all worked out, but it's not working. It's not a sadhana, it's not an effective means. Sometimes, and there's a whole, I think, area to do with the form of the practice and aspiration that has to be worked out. Perhaps there's even a tension there. It's something that we'd really like feedback on. The preceptors would like feedback on you know, how people get on with that dichotomy. We'd like to learn, you know, more how to explore this area. I find it very interesting looking back at my ordination. When I was ordained, it was quite one of those weird things. Bhante introduced me to my practice, which was Padmasambhava. It wasn't really going to be anything else. And he said to me, now, I'll give you the written sadhana, and write to me and to remind me, because I'm moving to, well, we didn't call it Padmaloka, because I'm moving to the new retreat centre, but write to remind me and I'll send you the sadhana. When he gave the mantra, it was very, very strong for me, very, very vivid. And I just, he said, in the meantime, just recite the mantra. And reciting the mantra was actually a very strong and vivid and devotional experience. And when I meditated, I didn't see Padmasambhava with all the gear and all the rest of it. What I saw was Sangharakshita. What I saw was Bhante, just as he looked at the time of the private ordination. And that was the kind of natural unfolding of what had happened. But having read too much and unwisely, I said, no, it should be Padmasambhava, with all the gear. And I wrote to Bhante, and of course he didn't send me the sadhana, not for years. Well, it seemed like years. But I, looking back, I really do wish, I really regret that I couldn't just go with the faith. I couldn't go with the intuition. I couldn't go with the devotion. That I got hung up on form. I got hung up on technique and structure because I'd read all these sort of mind-rotting tantric texts. But I find that a very interesting area, and perhaps there's lots to explore here. The Buddha or Bodhisattva on which we meditate is more than just a meditation. The form really provides us with a myth for our entire life. It's the unfolding of a myth in our life. And of course it should stimulate and awaken the imagination and rouse the dormant spiritual energies. Apparently Bhante said on one occasion he thought the descriptions, that he thought the Pure Land tradition, that particular approach was much more in a way effective than, Madhyamika and Yogacara, because it provided a myth, a way of rousing our dormant spiritual energies. And this is the place, I think, of sadhana. Recently, Subhuti wrote an article for Shabda saying that people being ordained wouldn't necessarily have to take up a sadhana in the sense of a visualization practice. Apparently some, maybe many order members don't do their sadhana in the sense of a visualization practice anyway. I think there's an important point to make in relation to this. Speaking as someone who has to make a final decision on someone's readiness for ordination, I certainly want to be sure that someone being ordained has some sort of vision or feeling for enlightenment, even if it's not for a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva form, some sort of envisagement of enlightenment, some form, some picture. Actually, these words aren't quite right. Perhaps better, some imaginative leap towards enlightenment. Nagasena speaks of faith as a leaping forward. Part of you intuits the goal. It's not just an idea, it's not just a concept, even though you might not connect with a particular bodhisattva. If you don't have that, what incentive would there be for practice? What incentive would there be to go for refuge, to take you beyond yourself? I know of an order member who at the time of ordination was given the Manjugosha sadhana. But his main practice is contemplation of the Heart Sutra. And when you talk to him, it's clear that the Heart Sutra for him is not a text. It's a world, a dimension. It's not a text or a set of ideas. It's something alive and living for him. And he went and talked to Bhante about this. He said, well, and described his contemplation of the Heart Sutra, but said that, I have real trouble with Manjugosha, meditating on Manjugosha. And Bhante said, well, Manjugosha holds the Prajnaparamita to his heart. You're contemplating what Manjugosha holds to his heart. And of course, it all came together for him. As with the other descriptions of enlightenment, I'll just add one more thing to this business about, form and freedom, if you like, in meditating on a bodhisattva. I remember being on a seminar with Bhante, actually it was the 1984 Tuscany, And Bhante was asked, well, will there be new bodhisattvas in the West? You know, will there be new figures emerging? And he said a number of very interesting things. But one of the things he talked about was how there comes a point, or there needs to come a point in your practice, perhaps naturally unfolding, perhaps as the product of discussion with your meditation instructor or your preceptor or whatever, where you need to kind of shift from meditating on the form of the deity to meditating on, as he said, as it were, the principle that the deity represents. By principle, he didn't mean idea or concept. He meant something kind of living. He said, supposing your sadhana is Manjigosha, he said, there comes a point where your life has to be the expression of the Manjigosha principle. Everything you do needs to be an expression of the Manjigosha principle. So that when you meditate, you just open up. You open up to however the Manjigosha principle manifests then in the sphere of meditation. Perhaps this is a stage of practice that would be premature for many of us, but perhaps it gives us a kind of feeling of where to go with our sadhana. Anyway, as with the other descriptions of enlightenment, much more could be said about this subject, but I really must move on, and move on to descriptions of enlightenment in terms of feeling and emotion. So enlightenment is feeling and emotion. Enlightenment is spoken of as peace, as tranquility, as shanti, and as yoga kshema, rest from exertion. That'd be lovely to not exert anymore and just rest. The three shantis at the end of the puja represent the pacification of the three fires. They represent the profoundest peace. They're the chant of final peace that comes when all craving, hatred and delusion have dissolved away. It's also spoken of, enlightenment, as bliss, as sukha. And I must say, I wonder if we dwell enough on this aspect of nirvana, of enlightenment, as bliss, happiness, ecstasy. Nirvanam paramang sukham, says the Buddha. Nirvana is the supreme bliss. This is the Buddha speaking in the Pali Canon. Herbert Gunter says a very interesting thing, that the experience of bliss, nirvanam paramang sukham, nirvana is the supreme bliss, comes before the kind of insight into the four truths of dukkha. Bliss comes first. The Buddha is described as the sugata, the one gone to a happy state. Of course, the bliss of nirvana is a different kind of bliss and happiness than we're used to. The bliss and happiness of enlightenment dawns when all distinctions between grasper and grasp, self and other, have been seen through, have fallen away. The great Mahasiddha Kunha says, the whole world, together with its deeds, words and thoughts, vanishes into the air. This vanishing is great bliss, the same as nirvana. Another tantric, Advayavadra, says, without bliss, there is no enlightenment, for enlightenment is bliss itself, unconditioned bliss, unconditioned happiness. Without bliss, there is no enlightenment. You don't have to look into the tantras to explore that. You find it in the Pali Canon. And it's related to the Buddha's realization before his enlightenment. You know, that period where he's doing all the ascetic practice, all the fasting. And he's just realizing he's just grinding to a halt. He's not getting anywhere. He's not getting any nearer to enlightenment. And he has that memory of that blissful and illumined meditation in his youth. And what he particularly remembers there was not just that he was well fed and strong then. He remembers that he was in a blissful state that arose from skillful states of mind. He'd been thinking before then that blissful, happy states were of themselves unskillful. But he realized that happy, blissful states that arose from skillful states was a good thing, was important. So when he realized it was important to take food, it wasn't a matter of just taking solid nourishment. It was also the recognition of the need for emotional and spiritual food and nourishment, of the importance of meditative, of spiritual pleasure. So there's that wonderful description of him entering into each of the dhyanas and enjoying the happiness, the sukha, and so on, but not getting caught up with it, not letting it dim his awareness, not getting attached to it. So it kind of just unfolded, each dhyana unfolded into the other dhyana, the bliss getting sweeter and more refined, on and on and on, and more open, until of course he realizes nirvana as the supreme bliss. It's a very, very important passage. Happiness, joy and bliss are our nourishment on the spiritual path. And Bhante's placed considerable emphasis on this. I think that's one of the reasons why he's made the spiral path so central, with its wonderful ascending order of faith, joy, ecstasy, calm, bliss, samadhi. And of course, the bliss doesn't disappear after samadhi and knowledge and things as they are. They're not mentioned, but of course, you must imagine it just gets better and better. I think also his emphasis on spiritual friendship, on nature, on the arts, on culture, on aesthetic experience, and its ethics as a kind of aesthetic experience, seeing others with love as they are, is all about refining the sources of pleasure. He's spoken of, it's not commonly known this, he's spoken of metta in one place as ecstatic. When you're in a state of metta, you're in a state of ecstasy. You get the bliss that comes from expansion, from standing outside of yourself through your identification with others. And a bliss like that makes us more vibrant and more alive and more perceptive and more sensitive to others. Happiness and love are intimately connected. I sometimes wonder if we shouldn't use the language of bliss and ecstasy more than we do. I sometimes think we ought to make more of it, being a bit into kind of the ecstatic, I suppose. But I really, when you look around at the world, you get the impression there's a real pursuit of ecstasy. People really want to kind of get outside of themselves. People talk about going clubbing. You get the impression that there's this kind of hunt for ecstasy. It's all over the place. Some kind of intense experience so that they can get off. There's some kind of attempt to get beyond the tyranny of selfhood, and of course it's not that successful. It doesn't seem to last very long. I think we've got something to say about it, something to contribute. And I don't mean like, being like a vicar who goes to a drum and bass club or something like that. I think the only way we can do it is to actually embody the bliss of liberation to some extent. And when you talk about it, if you talk about it, it actually comes from your experience of that. We can look for the ecstatic, the blissful, in our practice, which means, I think, looking beyond ourselves and our own concerns, developing a profound interest in what is beyond us. All those things I mentioned, arts, culture, friendship, other people, and so on. It's all about being interested, making the imaginative leap. We particularly need to look, I think, at the beauty of our spiritual ideal and the beauty in other people. I think people are often miserable because they're not interested in anything other than themselves. Saraha says, another great tantric, just as in deep darkness the moonstone spreads its light, so this supreme great bliss, in a moment, dissipates all misery. And not just for ourselves. It's understood that this bliss flows out to others, the great bliss of the enlightened man flows out as love and compassion for others, flows out as appreciation of others. seeing them as they are. Yes, they're suffering, but also seeing their beauty. In fact, that's even more central. I think the Buddha's vision after his enlightenment of all living beings as lotus flowers is essentially a vision of beauty and purity. The beauty and purity of us. Beauty and purity flowering in the mud, struggling, trying to struggle out of the mud. His compassion, his anukampa, his vibrating with us, derives from seeing that beauty, his actual spiritual beauty, transcendent beauty, his actual Buddhahood resonates with our potential beauty and Buddhahood. In later Buddhism, this kind of vision is described in greater detail in the Tathagata Garbha Sutra, the first sutra that deals with the Tathagata Garbha doctrine, that deals with this theme of the seed or the embryo of the Tathagata hidden in all beings, sometimes called Buddha nature. In this sutra, the Buddha describes his wisdom as the Buddha eye, which sees the way things are in terms of the Tathagata Garbha, hidden in the defilements of all beings. Seeing that, he goes to people and tells them that the Tathagata Garbha is there. The Buddha's compassionate activity, his loving kindness, points out the hidden Buddha potential in others. And the sutra uses beautiful images to describe this. Amongst other things, the Tathagata Garbha is likened to a precious golden ornament hidden in muck and filth and ordure. It's described as honey hidden by angry bees. It's described as golden statues covered with dirty rags, and so on. Everybody, all beings, have this amazing potential, but it's covered over by the vicissitudes of life. The Buddha's compassionate purpose is to awaken this great potential, to bring it forth, to spark it off, so that people live by it, so that they go for refuge. In some way or other, somehow or other, our own potential for enlightenment has been awoken. We have been able to say, for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. The important thing from now on is to stay connected to that potential for enlightenment. It doesn't really matter how. That's why I've covered a number of descriptions of enlightenment. What's so striking is what a range of descriptions there are. There's so many ways to connect, so many paths to follow, depending on your inclination. The important thing is not to forget. The important thing is to cherish that response, whatever it is. No matter what, sometimes life is very, very tough. Sometimes life is very tough in the order. There's kind of personal things, there's circumstances. Sometimes this can seem overwhelming. But we must never let go of that Buddha potential. We must continue to see the golden ornament in the filth. Remember, I used to experience this quite intensely when I lived in India. Sometimes I think for personal reasons, because of things that had happened in the past and also because of the circumstances of being in India, I found things very, very difficult, very painful, and it was hard to see sometimes the way forward. But there would always be some sign, something would happen to remind me to kind of look and to treasure and to cherish why I was doing what I was doing. I remember once in particular, I was staying with Chandrashil in his community in Ulhasnagar. And I went out onto the veranda. Well, it's just this cement block outside the back of his house. And I was cleaning my teeth early in the morning and spitting out onto the ground, as one does in India. And just before I was about to spit, I was looking at the rubbish and I saw, I don't quite even know how I saw it, amongst the rubbish, I thought, hang on a minute, they're mantras. They're Tibetan mantras. And it was a scrap of paper with mantras written on it. And I picked it up and thought, wow, how weird. Amongst all the sort of detritus that had just been swept down by the wind. There was this little set of Tibetan mantras. And it became a kind of symbol for what was important, to look, well, to look for the mantra in the rubbish. And Dada Rinpoche told me it was the mantra of Shakyamuni, the Buddha. But we don't just connect with our Buddha potential, with enlightenment, just for ourselves. Buddha nature is not personal. It's not personal. Everybody has it. In the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, there's great emphasis on compassion. The Buddha speaks to a sangha of bodhisattvas, and he exhorts them to look more deeply at others, to see more deeply, so that they will be more active in helping others to practice the Dharma. It's very important, this. So often when people speak about Buddha nature or potential, it can be another version of selfishness. There's a lot of emphasis on my potential, my true nature. It can be a kind of dressed up self preoccupation. In fact, in a commentarial work, it said that one of the reasons that the Buddha taught Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha, was to get people to be less proud and less fixated with themselves. Everybody has Buddha nature. Everybody has Buddha potential. So what's so special about you? And of course, there is no enlightenment without compassion, without love. No insight without love. It's not insight if it doesn't change your attitude to others, if it doesn't change your actions in relation to others. And there's no effective spiritual practice unless there is an unfolding outwards to others, unless there is a generosity towards others. If that isn't happening, I cannot believe that there is genuine spiritual attainment. Attainment, after all, is just not personal. I must say that's why I prefer the language of the arising of the bodhicitta rather than the language of insight. I think the language of insight can be so easily hijacked by the egotistical. I remember Paramahata telling me when he went to see Chetul Sungye Dorje, Paramahata was asking him the best way to meditate on Amitabha, which is his sadhana. And Paramahata was expecting a sort of technical discussion. He described his practice, and Chetul Rinpoche, you know, listened, and he just said, the best way to meditate on Amitabha is to do it for others. Do it for others. That's the most effective way of making progress in your practice. So, of course, this brings us to the last of the acceptance verses. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. We are ordained for the benefit of all beings. We are order members for the benefit of all beings. Going for refuge to the three jewels is for the benefit of others. There are so many ways to benefit others. So many ways whereby our practice can benefit people. To lift them up. To make their lives better. Personally, I take this verse to mean playing my part, along with all other order members, to bring the Dharma to others in whatever way. To make it available to others in whatever way. I wouldn't like to be specific about how we do that. To give others the opportunity to live according to the Dharma. Not because of some abstract notion of doing good, but because we like doing it. Because we love doing it. There's no point in doing it if you don't love it. We like doing it because a little of the great bliss flows forth, perhaps. The bliss that arises from our practice. The joy that arises from our practice. Bliss that is expressed in deeds of loving kindness. The love that flows forth from spiritual practice, especially from realization. If there's real realization, of course, it has great transforming power. And I wasn't going to read any Sufi poetry, but somebody sent me a book of a study of Sufi poetry. And I just opened the page, and this from Rumi's Matnawi just came out. And I thought, well, this has got to go in. From love, bitter things become sweet. From love, copper becomes golden. From love, the dregs become pure. From love, pains become medicine. From love, the dead are made alive. For all our many imperfections, we have a lot to offer as order members, individually and collectively. We have a lot to offer. We can offer so much meaning and value compared with what's going on in the world. And we can offer, I was going to say, a reasonably harmonious community, but actually, if you look at the world, a very harmonious community. It's worth standing back from time to time to take a look at the world. Take a look at a map of the world, and you probably noticed it when you do the order meta. You look at the number of order members, the number of centres. You know, I know we're not the only people doing good, of course we aren't. There's many, you know, we're just one part of things. But when you look, we're so tiny, we're so very small. You know, little lamps flickering in the darkness, and it's really weird sometimes. You know, you read some people's stuff, or hear some people speak, that the order and their movement are some incredibly huge, you know, kind of well-established institution. I mean, it's just not true. It's not true. I just don't see it like that. I just see us as little lamps flickering in darkness, and we've hardly begun. We're just lighting up the world just a little bit. And there are many, many more ways that we can benefit others. We've hardly begun. Perhaps essentially what we have to offer is summed up in the very verses we've been looking at. We can offer the world teachers, friends. We can offer a spiritual community. We can offer a harmonious spiritual community. We can offer a clear body of teaching and practice that leads to an enlightenment. We can offer all this for the benefit of all beings. So it's time to conclude. We've been looking at this weekend at the four acceptance verses recited in the public ordination ceremony. I hope you're finding the exploration useful. I must say I have. I feel that there's much more to say, much more to contemplate. I feel I've only just touched the surface of things. You know, there's much more that can be drawn out, and I hope all of you will draw things out. And of course, there's much, much more to do to fulfil these acceptance verses. So to conclude, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination.